Kevin Barrett here. Truth Jihad is the website. Please subscribe and enjoy. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, looking for truth in all the most painful places. And we're recording this interview with The Saker, one of our great alternative media commentators, here on Truth Jihad Radio for the first time, the day after Donald Trump gave a madman speech at the UN, threatening to totally destroy North Korea and shred the Iran agreement and making all sorts of belligerent and insane noises. So this is really a great time to bring on one of our best alternative voices. The Saker is a former strategic analyst who has been operating under this name, The Saker, and become a kind of alternative media legend. It's really, really good analysis and put out there on the internet for free. It's one of the great things about the world that we're in today, and we need all of the great things we can get given the other things that are going on. So let's get into it. Hey, welcome, Saker. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here with you. I look forward to our conversation.
Well, I've been wanting to interview you for quite some time. You may recall I've sent you a couple of invitations over the years, and for quite a while you were very reclusive as far as your radio interviews. It's great to actually get you on, especially at this moment. You know, so many people voted for Trump because they thought he was the peace candidate and that he would get along with Putin. The mainstream doesn't appreciate that. And now we have Trump looking a lot more crazy, belligerent, and let's face it, stupid than even George W. Bush ever did. What's going on?
Well, that's the question. There's going to be probably many PhD theses written about what's going on and how that happened. I agree with your diagnostic. He's actually worse than George W. Bush. It's extremely depressing. All I can say is in defense of those who did vote for him, and I'm not a U.S. citizen, so I couldn't vote. I wouldn't have voted. But I did think he was the only logical that was the right vote. Because a vote for Hillary was a vote for war with Russia specifically. And secondly, and that's, I think, crucial, is that the Trump that we saw as a candidate did say a number of rational, logical things. Of course, you know, it's always easy to say now in hindsight, you should have known better. Well, you know, maybe, but the choice was so stark that I think that a lot of people saw that as a single issue vote, which is for vote for war or for peace. And I think there was a hope, not an expectation, but a hope that Trump would have delivered on his promise of peace. And I think it would have been irresponsible not to take that opportunity to at least give him a chance to deliver on his promises. Of course, it ended up being an abject disaster. His presidency lasted, in my opinion, 30 days. That's it took a month for the neocons to toss out General Flynn. At that point, it was clear that there was a coup happening. Not that Flynn is a big hero of mine. I find Flynn reasonable on some issues and completely unreasonable on others. But Flynn was a very close ally and main advisor to Trump. So when Flynn was thrown out, it was clear that, first of all, the neocons had won, and secondly, that Trump did not have the spine or honor to stand by his friends. So he would bend over and take it, and he did. And ever since, it's been a horrible, you know, just painful, embarrassing disaster of one embarrassment after another. And we just saw Trump become what we saw yesterday at the United Nations. And that is a megalomaniac, you know, full of typical hubris, arrogance, and frankly, mind-boggling stupidity. So it's a very sad event to see that.
Well, one of the questions that arises when you see a speech like that is who wrote it? You know, Donald Trump probably isn't writing his own speeches the way he may be writing some of his own tweets. And then there's Bibi Netanyahu over in the corner, cheering and chortling and smirking. It almost seemed like a cartoonish illustration of who's really in control now.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. I mean, I never, study the Trump administration on micro level. I look at it as a whole. So I personally did not spend a lot of time trying to guess who wrote the speech. But there's a couple of commentators on my blog who are very savvy in that. And they gave a couple of names. What's clear is that there are people who wrote the speech for him, and that the real author of the speech is, of course, Bibi Netanyahu. Of course, absolutely.
Just as when Bush gave his famous Axis of Evil speech, you know, one of the other insane, belligerent speeches from an American president, that was written by David Frum, who is a hardcore neocon extreme Zionist who threw North Korea into this Axis of Evil that was mainly focused on the enemies of Israel. And at the time, it looked like an afterthought. And North Korea went on testing these nuclear weapons and so on and making belligerent noises, threatening to nuke Washington, D.C. for many, many years. And neither Bush nor Obama seemed to care that much. And so I assumed that maybe it was all about really, you know, Israel's security. The post 9/11 USA had had its foreign policy taken over by Netanyahu and Frum and the neocons. But today, it seems that they're itching for their big Mideast war with Iran, and somebody is also pushing Trump towards war with North Korea, which would likely mean war with Russia and China. So the question would be, are the neocons only interested in preserving expansionist Israel, or are they lunatics who want to impose an American Israeli empire on the entire world?
Well, that's another complicated issue, which is much debated. My personal take on it is that the neocons don't really care about Israel. They use Israel as an ideological tool, just the same way they use the Holocaust, as they constantly, you know, hammer this issue about the Holocaust. But they really don't care about any victims of Hitler or anything else. They're using these arguments for their own power. I think that their real loyalties to themselves. I don't think they, if they were responsible, they wouldn't, you know, Israel does not, in reality, Israel does not at all benefit from the kind of Zionist policies that we see. At least the people of Israel don't benefit from the policies that we see from the U.S. and from the Likud government in power there, or generally their power. They have the same problem as here, is that the regime there is basically ideological. Their real loyalty is to the empire. And I think that that empire is more important than Israel. Secondly, though I do agree that the Israel lobby plays a huge role. It's the number one lobby in the country, no doubt about it. And I do agree that the neocons are the number one, how shall I call it, force today, and that controls, you know, 100% of Congress, 100% of the media. And basically now they've taken over the White House. So it looks pretty sad for us now. But I would not say that their real loyalties, you know, that they really care about Israel. I think it's much more a tool that's used ideologically for them to seek world domination. I think that's much more what's happening.
That makes sense to me, too. And if you get into their Straussian philosophy, Strauss really was teaching a kind of extreme egotistical psychopathic selfishness that would hold no loyalty to anybody at all other than one's own interests. But how about the pushback from the alternative commentary world? It seems that the empire is a little bit worried right now that there are alternative voices out there. There was just a piece in the New York Times Magazine claiming that RT is the greatest propaganda operation in history. And it seems they're wringing their hands about the fact that a lot of folks are listening to people like you and me and RT and not believing everything they read in the New York Times. You think there's going to be a crackdown on internet-based free speech because of this?
It's already happening. First of all, search engines are manipulating their results for searches. Secondly, we all know about all the, you know, the demonetization of politically incorrect channels on YouTube. So the way we have to understand that the way to crack down on free speech is not to have somebody, you know, a SWAT team smashing down their door, arresting you, beating you up, and sitting, putting you in some kind of dungeon. That's not how they do it. What they do it basically is by trying to, they haven't succeeded yet, but doesn't mean they can't, by trying to make you more or less invisible or irrelevant on the internet. By demonizing you, by labeling you, branding you, you know, either some Muslim terrorist supporter or a Putin agent or what's, you know, North Korean sympathizer, whatever label they can put on you. I mean, it's all happening. I think they're trying extremely hard to get the internet under control. That is already a crackdown on free speech, absolutely.
Yeah, you wrote a piece about this called First They Came for the Nazis and Pedophiles. And I thought that was pretty good. You know, now it does seem post-Charlottesville We could all say, well, first they came for the Confederate Nazis.
Well, the reason why I use the example of Nazis and pedophiles is that because in the Western society today, these are the two ultimate villains that I call them consensus villains. So these are the two entities that everybody is supposed to hate. And if you don't hate them, then you're a monster. So what they do, they took those consensus villains and they developed the tools, legal and technological, to crack down on everybody by developing these tools towards these two consensus villains. That's why I use this quote about first they came for, because, you know, if you say, well, you know, they cracked down on Nazis and pedophiles, everything's going to go, yeah, great. I mean, this is, you know, that's exactly what most people want. But then they have developed the full arsenal, and then they'll go after everybody else, because their real problem, as you say correctly, is that they want to be a monopoly. And they had, for years, they had a monopoly on information, on communications. And that monopoly, the genie got out of the bottle with the internet. And now, you know, Press TV, Russia Today, and others are starting to penetrate this market on which the Anglo-Zionists had a complete monopoly. And that, of course, freaks them out completely.
It should. Well, you've been in the alternative media game for a while, and you've built up a pretty sizable audience. Maybe you could explain how that happened.
You know, largely by coincidence. To make a long story short, I worked in Switzerland, and that's where I was born, actually. I was born in a family of Russian emigres in Switzerland, studied in the United States for a while, came back to Switzerland. And then I worked first in strategic intelligence, then in disarmament issues in the United Nations. And a lot of what I wrote was classified, and basically I lost my career there over the war. It all began for me with the wars in the former Yugoslavia, which opened my eyes to the hypocrisy and lies, of the empire. I could see I was getting classified reports every day telling me the true story. Then I could see the narrative, the mainstream narrative, which was false on every single level. So I couldn't keep my mouth shut, lost my career, and came to the United States because I married also a person from Russian extraction like myself, but she's an American citizen. So we could come here because I was basically blacklisted in Switzerland. And I started a blog, which was just, scratching a niche for myself, just writing whatever the hell I wanted. Actually, my very first post was about a Zionist conference in Herzliya in Israel, where I was saying that these people are basically preparing for war. That was my very first post. And I wrote mostly about the Middle East because I'm very interested in Hezbollah as a movement and in Lebanon and the entire topic of Israel in the Middle East. And my blog was not very well known because there was really not much demand for that. I did it for myself. But as a former Cold Warrior, as somebody from Russian extraction, I knew the Soviet Union very well and the countries which successor states. And when suddenly in the Ukraine there was an orange, you know, a coup organized, basically, I started writing about that. And that made my blog unique because there was a blog written by a guy who writes in English, for basically an English-speaking audience, but written from a Russian point of view. And that got me suddenly a lot of people start reading it, and it really exploded to my immense surprise. I never tried to promote it, never did any kind of thing. I was writing for myself. And the events thrusted me suddenly in the middle of this alternative media, specifically on the Ukraine. But for all the first, you know, couple of years that I was writing it, I never wrote about the Ukraine at all.
Interesting. Well, can you compare your experience dealing with the strategic analysis involving all kinds of classified information and this open source intelligence world that you're now part of on the internet? Robert David Steele, who sometimes fancies himself as the father of the open source intelligence movement, he's a former CIA clandestine services officer who's done a lot of very interesting work. He says that the open source intelligence world has really overtaken the old intelligence community, and you can figure out what's going on better through open sources now than you used to be able to do by building up all kinds of classified sources and secret sources and going through classified documents. So how do you compare sort of those two worlds?
I would say it's apples and oranges, because the conventional wisdom is that 80% of the information needed to take decisions on a state level is available in the open. Then another 50% is proprietary, which means, you know, it's commercial secrets and things like that, banking, finance. And only about 5% would be actually classified information. And what's classified is mostly the sources are classified. A second thing that would be typically classified is highly technical or time-critical things. And finally, you classify corruption. That's a good way of hiding what you're doing. You know, you call it a state secret, and you don't hide, and you don't show the taxpayer what's done with its money. So I would say it's apples and oranges. I certainly I was asked very often, particularly during the with the beginning of the Ukrainian crisis. You know, a lot of people thought there was maybe a former Russian intelligence officer. They got my language skill and ethnic origin confused with my citizenship. And they believe that I had very good sources, classified sources.
There's a huge hunger for that kind of thing. Sorcha Fowl has built up a ridiculous career based on that.
Yeah, well, the reality is that by the time I came to the United States in 2002, I had absolutely no access to any kind of classified sources. All I had, I made a lot of correct guesses about what would happen in the Ukraine. And why I could do that is it's a combination of two simple things. You know, education, I knew what I was talking about, and educated guesses. That's all you need to understand a conflict or a situation. So I would say to those people who never have had access to classified sources, don't worry. It's no big deal. It's really not pertinent to a private individual trying to, understand the world he lives in.
So how does the classified world deal with these gigantic falsehoods like 9/11, for example? And in the previous generation, we could have had the 60s assassinations of the Kennedy brothers and so on. These are momentous events, and one's interpretation of what's really going on in the world largely hinges on them. You know, people who are living in the false world in which 9/11 was carried out by 19 guys with box cutters under the command of a guy on dialysis in a cave in Afghanistan are living in a very, very different world from the people who know that that's not true. So how does that kind of dichotomy get reflected in the official world? I still don't understand how policy can actually be made by people who are so deluded that they believe that kind of official lie.
Well, okay, first of all, the intelligence process is usually very often described as a combination of, acquisition. First of all, is getting the information. Analysis is understanding the information. And then acceptance, the third A. And you can have one mechanism by which the people that you work for, to whom you provide intelligence, actually refuse to accept it. I mean, and that's a major problem. Are the intelligence people listened to or not? And not only intelligence, generally specialists, are they listened to or not? But secondly, even more germane to that is the fact that, intelligence agencies are bureaucracies. They also have career path management there. They have personnel issues. They have, petty office politics, etc. So once political pressure starts to be put, and the more influence an intelligence agency has, the more there's political pressure on it, you're pressured to toe the line. I mean, I've seen it very clearly. I can tell you from my own example. My colleagues knew exactly what was going on in the former Yugoslavia. None of that nonsense, all the false flag that took place there. It was absolutely clear. Even UNPROFOR knew that, say, the Markali bombings, etc., were false flags. Everybody knew. But the thing is, you were made to understand that you better shut up and not argue with the political zeitgeist, the official narrative. And for my own sins, I did. I couldn't keep my mouth shut a number of issues, including the ones that got me in trouble was Swiss neutrality, because I actually believed in neutrality, and a lot of my colleagues did, and a lot of them resigned over that. Switzerland was becoming hopelessly allied with NATO. Secondly, the lies about the wars in Yugoslavia, which pretty much every single word written about that conflict is a lie. And then third, conflict in Chechnya. And I knew, and I was naive then. I was young. I thought, if I'm a good analyst, I prove my case, I can convey that. No, it got me blacklisted. So, that's how it is. You can't do that.
Yeah, I've noticed it works that way in the academy occasionally, too.
Absolutely.
I started talking about 9/11 in ways that you weren't supposed to. I suddenly had some huge political problems that I never anticipated.
Absolutely. I think the worlds are very similar, actually, in a way. I mean, at least the analysis part of intelligence is what? Is academics or specialists trying to analyze or comment on reports? They use different sources maybe, and they have a different audience. But the two are very similar, and you get shot if you go against the mainstream.
Well, today it seems that there's a real official push to re-demonize Russia. I remember when I was growing up, I was born in 59, so I grew up with all kinds of Cold War era anti-communist Russophobia everywhere. And as I became politically conscious in my early teens, I reacted against it and sort of joined the peace movement for Vietnam and, you know, tried to de-demonize communism. But it seemed at that time that Russophobia was totally wedded to anti-communism. And one could never have even imagined that Russia would lose communism, would become post-communist, would go back to its identity with a Russian Orthodox Church. You know, we were always told these were godless communists. We had to fight them because they hated God. They were anti-religious. And today, there's an Orthodox revival, but that's cast as a bad thing. We're told that these religious bigots, you know, won't allow pussy rioters to come in and mess with their cathedrals. I'm completely confused. Maybe I just, you know, I haven't managed to erase my previous memories in the proper Orwellian fashion. But it's very, very strange. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how the changes in Russia and the revival of the Orthodox Church, which you're a part of, are fit into this larger picture of the empire demonizing its enemies.
Well, first of all, I have to tell you, it's a painful subject for me personally, because I used to be a very naive and very loyal Cold Warrior. Having been born from a family of refugees from the Bolshevik Civil War, I'm a white Russian, I was raised as a rabid anti-communist. I mean, to me, communism was just literally the worst, most abominable thing that ever happened. I mean, that's what I was raised in. And frankly, the kind of environment that was, you know, as a teenager, et cetera, in Europe, Cold War, then you know, my studies all confirmed that. So I felt very comfortable, and I think like a lot of people in, who come from Eastern Europe and Central and in Russia, you know, there was no contradiction between me feeling that I, you know, belonged to the Russian culture and loved it. And I was always very close to my country of origins. And I always, you know, I kept the culture very much and the language. At the same time, being, you know, a loyal part of the anti-communist bloc of the West was totally compatible. I never thought then that the element of Russophobia was so crucial at the core of the anti-Soviet rhetoric in the West. Some Russian authors began noticing it. I mean, Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote about that. Igor Shafarevich wrote about that. Others did. We noticed small things happening, weird things. For instance, I'll give you an example that practically nobody in the West knows about. There used to be Russian nationalists or Orthodox Christians opposed to the Soviet regime in the Soviet Union. And interestingly, they always got stronger sentences, harsher sentences, than those dissidents who were liberal Democrats pro-Western. Not only that, and literally the difference, even articles of the Soviet penal codes, typically, you know, the Sakharov were the kind of refuseniks or, you know, pro-Western dissidents would get Article 190 of the penal code, which gave them, you know, three to four years, I think, of detention. The nationalists and the Orthodox were typically getting Article 70, which would give them at least 7 years of harsh labor, if not even Article 64, treason to the country. So they were treated harsher by the Soviets, but interestingly, nobody in the West supported them. And that was the first thing that sort of set off the alarms. Secondly, the way Solzhenitsyn actually was received in the West. He was a hero for the West while he was critical of the Soviets, but when he came to the West and became critical of the West, he was suddenly, you know, treated like an anti-Semite, a monarchist, as if that was very bad to be a monarchist, but whatever. Clearly, this started building, and gradually I myself came to realize that the non-Russophobic anti-communist West was actually a minority. The majority was actually a centuries-old Russophobia, which literally began 1,000 years ago with at the time of the Crusades and even before the schism between the Rome and the rest of the Christian world. So the roots of that Russophobia are extremely ancient. They are, how should I put it? They're carried by different groups who have a beef with Russia. That's the papacy, first of all. Jews, second group. The Anglo Empire is a third group. There are all sorts of constituent groups in the West who have a deep resentment of the Russian Empire, which turned over the years into almost quasi-racist hatred for Russia. But yeah, it took me a long time to come to these conclusions, and now it's in the open. Now it's actually undeniable.
So let's talk a little bit about the Orthodox Church. I recently had Guy Mettan on the show, and he's written that great new book on Russophobia. He traces the history of this antagonism towards Russia back to the Great Schism, when the popes emerged as the rivals of the Greek Orthodox Church, which then became sort of the center of Russian identity. It seems like a kind of a strange thing to have this thousand-year-old religious issue be so important in what's largely a secular world today, in which most of the elites don't really seem to believe in anything.
Yes and no. It actually does play a role ideologically. What used to be a religious, right now in the West, I think we're living in a post-Christian society. So there's no way you can say that there is a religious solidarity between Russophobes today and the Russophobes 1,000 years ago. But what happened is that the hatred of the papacy for the Christian world, because the papacy basically claimed that it was the Christian world. It wanted to be, not only Christian world, but rule over it. And of course, the rest of Christian world refused that. And ever since, the papacy has been fighting for that position. And that, if you want, imperial mindset, desire to be number one and rule over the entire planet, is what shaped West European culture. Because if you look, what are the real roots of Western European culture? They come straight out of the Middle Ages. Western European culture is not based in Rome, or even less so in Greece. And the simple proof for that is that if you look at Rome, who became an empire, and in 20 BC, Constantinople was founded in the 4th century. Rome was sacked in the 5th century. But really, Rome continued to exist for another 1,000 years until Constantinople was run over by the Ottomans in 1453. So the Roman civilization truly existed for another 1,000 years, which is hardly ever mentioned in Europe.
Yeah, right. We're not taught that in our school books here.
Well, there's a reason why, because that presents a challenge to the official narrative that, the West is then the heir to the Roman Empire, which it isn't. The West has been shaped by the papacy and is an heir to the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, and basically the kind of Europe that the papacy built. Well, if you have at the core of your foundation of your civilization a religion which is fantastically hostile to the rest of the Christian world, and on top of that, that militarily fails to conquer it, because the other thing is why Russia was so odious to West Europeans, because they attacked it many times over and always failed. The Russians are the only white people out there, white by skin color. I don't like the category, but Europeans use it, so I'll use it, their rhetoric. I would say European-looking people that actually refuse the European civilizational model. So that's very offensive. It's a challenge. They perceive that as being, a dangerous civilizational challenge. And that is what Russia is today. Absolutely. I think that culturally Russia goes way deeper than just, the politics or the economics of the Russian policies today. They do put people in jail for desecrating a cathedral. They do ban homosexual parades in downtown Moscow. And they are not apologetic about it. To take the example of homosexuality, homosexuals are not persecuted in Russia. That's absolutely nonsense. They have clubs, they have organizations, they live just fine. The only thing that the Russian society says is that you cannot aim apology or propaganda of a homosexual lifestyle towards children. That underlines the real offense, is the underlying thought, is that homosexuality is not a normal and healthy variation of human sexuality. So basically what the Russians are doing is denying a healthy equality status to homosexuals. And that's profoundly offensive to Western homosexuals. But, it's the same thing in the Islamic world. They're not going to yield on that either. So these are civilizational challenges. I think that Russia, just like the Muslim world today, present the West with a challenge which is much deeper than just economics or control over the raw materials or politics. It's a civilizational model.
And one wonders really why, whether you tolerate homosexuals by just letting them do their thing as long as they don't frighten the horses and the children, or whether you mandate bringing them into the schools to talk to the children. I mean, is that really the issue that we should fight World War III over? Why is that kind of stuff so important?
Because it's one of the colors of a large palette of demonization of Russians. But it's not Russia exclusively. Again, I mean, the way the Muslim world is now demonized in the Western media is exactly the same. It's crude. It's basic. It's basically illiterate, sophomoric. And the idea is to paint a devil against whom then we have to struggle and fight. And we end up with speeches like yesterday. We had Trump, you know, he didn't mention Russia very much. But you look at the inanities he said about Iran. It just blows your mind. It's counterfactual to the extreme. If anything, you know, if you are against ISIS, Daesh, and all that kind of Wahhabi, crazy terrorism, Iran is the number one country fighting it.
That's right.
They should have our full support and gratitude. And they played a fantastic role. He lost generals in the fight against, not, you know, like U.S. We're sitting in deeply. They hardly lose anybody. The Iranians lost generals.
Yeah, we're running Daesh. We're helping Daesh.
Exactly. That's the truth. Yeah. You're absolutely. That's the exact truth. And Iran is the number one country fighting them. And yet, you know, they're painted like terrorists.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, getting back to the civilizational clash, I guess, and Huntington did say that the Eastern Christian world was a separate civilization that would be clashing with the West in the same way that Islam would be. Sheikh Imran Hossein, with whom you've had some very interesting conversations that I urge listeners to check out, is of the opinion that the Orthodox Christian world, or the non-Catholic Protestant, you know, Eastern Christian world, should be working with the Islamic world to resist the kind of unholy alliance of the Zionists and the Western Christians. And he identifies that alliance with Gog and Magog, or Juj and Yajuj from the Quran, which would be this kind of demonic force unleashed in the end times. So you think he's onto something?
Yes, I do. First, I have to agree that if you look on a spiritual level, at the core of the empire, I think it is demonic, quite literally. I know a lot of people who smirk about that. I'm a religious person. I don't believe this is all abstract symbolic language. I think demons and Satan do exist. And I think that that model that runs the empire today is absolutely satanic. Secondly, there is, and there's an interesting here, again, comparing civilizations. Russia has a very different historical past with Islam, if you compare, for instance, with the Balkans. The Balkans suffered terribly under the Turkish yoke, and not all, but a lot. I would say the majority of Orthodox people in these countries have a knee-jerk reaction against Islam, which they completely conflate with the Ottoman Empire, and it's a huge mistake. I always tell them, why do you conflate these two? But you would be, how would you feel if somebody conflated the papacy and the Orthodox Church? And then they go like, that's for them sounds, but that's very different. No, it's not. You know, Islam is diverse, so is the Orthodox world, so, and the Christian world. So I think that in the Russian, Russia had wars, including 12 wars with Turkey. And Russia had to fight at different times of her history against Muslim opponents. But Russians also lived side by side with Muslims. There is a sizable Muslim population inside Russia. They lived in good, they were good neighbors to each other. In fact, a lot of, even Chechens were actually elite guards for the Russian Tsars before the revolution. So it's much more nuanced than that. And the kind of Islam that you see in Russia really is not a threat to the Orthodox people at all. And I think that Russia, again, being a different civilizational model, one thing that is completely absent in Russia today is that sense of an Islamic threat. Yeah, there is an acute sense of the Wahhabi threat, absolutely. And, you know, they fought them in Afghanistan, they fought them in Chechnya, they're fighting them today in Syria. They know exactly who they're dealing with. But there is not that conflation of Islam with one sect of Islam. So I think that the Muslim world today, like Russia, is undergoing a profound crisis. I mean, this is a long topic, but basically I think that both Russian Orthodoxy and Islam, traditional Islam, are struggling very hard to find their true roots and to develop a healthy alternative to, you know, they each have their own problems. But fundamentally, do I think that Orthodox and Muslims can coexist and should and even unite? Yes, absolutely. I agree with that idea very much. We have a common enemy, which is a mortal enemy for both of us. And I don't see any reason at all for an inherent antagonism between Eastern Orthodox Christians and Islam as such. I'm not talking again about the Ottoman Empire, which I would put a parenthesis around.
Right, and that could be another long discussion, because I hear so many different perspectives on Turkish history and the Ottoman Empire from different people. I have mm-hmm. Turkish friends here. One of my friends is a former professor at the University of Wisconsin who's from a Turkish background and takes a relatively sort of positive view of Ottoman history. There has been this long-term clash between the Ottomans and the Orthodox world in Russia. And it's hard to tell for sure, you know, who's entirely the good guy there, since they're both fighting each other, going back and forth. And maybe because the Ottomans tended to be losing for the last couple of centuries, you know, it's easy to see them as the underdog if you're Muslim and identify with them, and maybe miss some of the reasons that they're not so popular over in the Balkans among certain people. In any case, so that leads to the question of dealing with minorities. You wrote a great essay called Manipulated Minorities, pointing out that the empire loves to rile up minorities and get them fighting as part of its divide and conquer strategy. And how's that working with Russia? You mentioned that Muslims generally seem to be doing okay in Russia. That was the impression I got from leaders of the Muslim community in Russia that I spoke to in Tehran. So how does a country that's based on a particular church, in this case, the Orthodox Church, like Russia is, deal with religious minorities and have, you know, how can it be pluralistic while still being based on one particular religious outlook?
I think that Chechnya is what is the crucial defining event. When the war started in Chechnya, the first war, Russia almost fell apart, I would say. I think, you know, we'll never know for a fact, but I think Russia came very close to falling apart as a country and as a civilization subsequently. And out of the Chechen War, there came a wisdom on both sides, I think. The Russians realized that they needed Muslim allies to fight the Wahhabi rot and the kind of terrorism that was taking place there, which was an abomination. It was Daesh. It was just as bad as Daesh. And I think people in power in Russia realize a simple thing, is that you can kill all, you know, any amount of Muslims, but you can't kill an ideology. And only true Muslims can kill the Wahhabi ideology. So it becomes vital for the Russians to support. I'm talking, first of all, you can't be Russian and Muslim, okay? So I make it sound like it's a contradiction. So I would say non-Muslim Russians, which are either religious or not. I remind you that the majority of people in reality call themselves religious, but they're not that religious in Russia yet. Let's not over-exaggerate that. It's a cultural thing more than a profoundly religious thing. But I think that the people in power in Russia came to a realization that at the forefront of the struggle against the Wahhabis, you have to have the traditional imams and the kind of traditional Islam that has always been present in the territories we're discussing. And these people suffered a tremendous, they were killed, murdered, bombed by the Wahhabis with extreme viciousness. They paid with their blood, which is always forgotten. And now in Russia, people see that. It's very interesting that you look in the 90s, the Chechens were considered as, you know, blood-drinking barbarian terrorists, and now there are a lot of people see them as heroes who are actually even fighting in the Donbass to defend Orthodox Christians against the Ukrainian Nazis. So it tells you how things can change fast. So there came this realization, first of all, and then look at it from the point of view of the local Muslim community. They are not big enough. They are not strong enough. They don't have what it takes to protect themselves. They can be turned into a Syria really fast, and they realize that. Whereas if you're a Chechen or a Muslim from any other part of Russia today, you realize that you have the full might of the Russian state protecting you against the Wahhabis. And that's a vital thing for you too. So again, it's a matter of survival for both groups.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Well, in your Manipulated Minorities essay, you took a kind of an approach that cuts across the grain of political correctness, which is all these days, a lot of it at least, is based on identity politics, focusing primarily on minority identities with this sort of implicit idea that the minority is always an oppressed group, should be proud as an oppressed group. You know, I think that first became extremely successful with Jews in the West who have both suffered greatly and profited greatly from their status as an allegedly oppressed minority. But now everybody's jumped on that bandwagon, it seems like. And here in the West, you're really very politically incorrect if you even question any of this. Which you just did.
Yeah, I did. I like doing that.
Yeah. So why is it that we shouldn't be seeing the whole world through this prism of oppressed minorities everywhere, and the holiness and purity of any given government or country is to be judged on how it treats its minorities?
Because minorities, and I very much come from a minority, in many, I explained at the beginning of my article, in many ways of my, an identity is not only one thing, it's a multi-layered cake, but I'm in a minority in very many ways. And I can tell you minorities are different. Minorities are, for instance, usually far more driven, far more aware of their identity, and it makes them disproportionately influential in a democratic society. So I came to the conclusion that the real purpose of democracy is not to protect the minorities from the oppression of the majority, but more often it is to protect the majority from the oppression of the minorities. Because the other thing that minorities can do, they start form coalitions between different minority groups, all who have a grudge against the majority group. And we see that very clearly today in the United States. I think that nobody will deny that the Democratic Party generally is indeed a very diverse party. People vote Democrat for many, many, many different reasons. If you compare that to the Republicans, and I'm not a Republican, I'm even placing myself on that, continuum of debate, but generally it is true that Republicans are white, more Anglo-Saxon. There is a majority in this country which is white Anglo-Saxon. And look the way it's treated by those liberal elites. It's treated with hatred. And I would say that, the white Anglo-Saxon male today is persecuted in the United States. Absolutely. And so, is that a normal situation? No, it shouldn't be happening. So there's a real danger that minorities, particularly when they are driven enough, and that's crucial, people always say, oh, they're so talented. It's not true. They're much more driven. They spend much more time. For instance, when I was, okay, I was born in Switzerland, where really I was born, lived in Geneva most of my life, which is an extremely diverse city. It's international. It's not even really Swiss. It's a hodgepodge of different. I never thought of racial issues whatsoever. Never. And then I moved to the United States to study. I lived in Washington, D.C. from 86 to 91. I was stunned. First, I couldn't get it that I was actually treated as a white guy by black people. I had no idea what their beef with me was until I finally figured out that it's my skin color. So, and that's the thing. If you're a majority and you feel comfortable, you don't think about these things the same way if you do a business deal. It's very well known that, a Jewish businessman seeing another Jew competing for, say, bidding for something, will identify him as a fellow Jew. Well, the Anglo who waltzes in there has no idea what's happening. Minorities in that sense are very different in the way they operate. And I think it is a real danger to start catering them to them, because they're usually the two dangerous things about minorities are they're single issue people. And secondly, their agenda does not really threaten the empire or the power structure. That's why the Democrats are so happy to cater into the homosexuals and to the liberals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because none of what these guys demand in any way threatens the social order here.
Nor does it threaten the dominance of the plutocrats and the oligarchs.
Absolutely.
And in fact, it distracts from it. All of this hoopla over Charlottesville, for example, strikes me as a case of identity politics gone berserk, as we see so often. And all of that, it sucks all the action out of the room. Everybody's focusing on the identity politics, and the political
Exactly.
left says, "Oh, this is where it's at. We should be out with Antifa, fighting
Yeah.
these retrograde Confederates." And instead, they've completely forgotten the Bernie Sanders program of trying to get some economic social justice, which of course would cost the elite where it counts in the pocketbook. And so I think the elite is promoting this minority stuff, this political correctness and identity politics stuff, which leads to the next question. I've had a number of guests who suspect or even explicitly argue that Charlottesville was some kind of false flag. Or at least, manipulated and maybe staged in certain ways to try to get this fight going precisely to focus all the attention on those particular issues. Is that possible?
Well, possible, yes, of course. Do I know that this is the case? I don't know that. Frankly, I did not have the time or the energy to really dissect what happened there, who did what, why the helicopter fell, whether the car incident was staged. I don't know. Is it possible? Yeah, I mean, false flags are absolutely real. There's a couple of them, starting with 911, about which I have no doubt whatsoever. I've seen, how false flags were executed in Yugoslavia. Could that be another one? Yes. Do I know that? No, I don't.
Okay, that's where I am still, too. Even though I've had a number of radio guests who've argued for the false flag interpretation, I still need to see more proof to be sure. We're talking about how minorities get all of this attention, identity politics becomes the rage, and pretty soon that's pretty much all you're seeing in the analysis, and the left gets hoodwinked and put to sleep. How about the scapegoating that goes with it? It seems that a lot of identity politics is based on this human propensity for scapegoating, and so the oppressed minority is a group that's been scapegoated and blamed for things the way African Americans have been blamed for the chaotic nature of human sexuality. There was a period where black men were being lynched for crimes they didn't commit because the sexual insecurity of the white men, you know, projected on the black men. And so we see this scapegoating process all over the place. In fact, René Girard argues that this is the central aspect of human nature. But it seems that it gets misdirected so often. That's basically the nature of the scapegoating process is to go after innocent people or people that you shouldn't be going after. You wrote an essay recently arguing that the Jew haters who plague your comments section, as they sometimes plague mine, the people who are just absolutely rabidly one topic, hating on Jews and blaming Jews for everything in the world, of course not that Jewish nationalism and Zionism aren't grossly disproportionate evils in today's world, but there are these people who are utterly irrational about it, and scapegoating Jewish people. And you argued that if you want to blame somebody, you should be blaming billionaires, not Jews. Can you elaborate on that?
I think you might be referring to the recent article by Eric Zuss about the percentage of Jews among...
Right, in your commentary on it, yeah.
Yeah, well, I didn't write that article. I actually, and that's the first time, I never said that. I'm critical of that article on several aspects. I think it is too narrowly focused, too narrowly defined to make a convincing case on many issues. But anyways, I would say that that obsession with one simple explanation is usually the, first of all, it's the result of a lazy mind. It's simple to explain things away by a single overwhelming factor. It's the Jews or the Russians or the blacks or any other, the Muslims, of course. It's usually just laziness. It's simple. It provides for a psychologically comfortable thing. It's some other guy, and this guy is really bad. I think this is the key of it. Frankly, it's human stupidity. A lot of people are not willing to look at an issue from, you know, all aspects, including the aspect for the point of view of the other guy, that you should also try to see how he feels about it, where he's coming from. And secondly, it's extremely dangerous because when you say, if you let that, that's why I fought that on my blog, you know, and I'm still fighting that kind of stuff. And I always try to explain that, you know, if you say the Jews did this or that, not only are you being unfair, because it's factually wrong, it's not the Jews, they're a different group. You're pointing your finger at innocent people, but a lot of people are unbothered by that. But there's two other side effects, really vicious from that. There are a lot of non-Jewish SOBs who get away. The spotlight is not on them, which should start bothering everybody. You know, if you don't care about being unfair to Jews, be at least worried about having non-Jewish sons of bitches hide behind that and get away literally very often with murder. And finally, this is dangerous because you force people to basically stand shoulder to shoulder together. That's extremely... Well, the example that comes to my mind today is the Muslims. If you say, you know, the Muslims are the problem, you're threatening all of them together as a group, and you're pushing them towards each other. Do you really want to fight all the Muslims on the planet? Or is it much, much more rational, regardless of ethical aspects, of being very surgical and say, okay, we do have a real problem with Wahhabi Islam. Let's focus on that. So it's bad tactically, it's bad morally. That kind of thinking is just poor thinking. It's frankly stupid.
Yes, I agree completely. Well, in terms of Wahhabi Islam being a problem, it may be a problem to those of us who have humane values, but for the managers of the empire, it's very convenient in so many ways. You know, strategically, it is a great divide and conquer operation against Islam and the Middle East, and it's, you know, they can weaponize it and turn it against Russia, use it as a false flag to justify their military budgets, and so on. So It seems that the public is totally hoodwinked on this. They're, you know, the Islamophobia post 9/11 has gotten so far away from reality that the mainstream discourse has everything backwards.
Yeah, I just have to tell you, I lost audio with you for a couple of seconds. I might have missed something of what you said, but I think I got most of it. But you know, the paradox is at the same time that there is this Islamophobia, at the same time there is also a political correctness on always saying, you know, it's not Islam, it's not Muslims either. So it's, people are torn between a primitive point of narrative on one side and a primitive narrative on the other side. And that's, you know, if you look at the format of our of the public, you know, the mainstream media, that's how it works. If your interviews last 3 minutes and your essays are 300 words or something like that, that's all you can squeeze in there. You end up having a generation of people who think in categories which are slogans rather than, you know, a discourse on something.
I agree completely. Well, getting back to this issue of the kind of so-called clash of civilizations, is it possible that the West, which grows, as you said, out of the papacy, which wanted to completely monopolize and subjugate the whole Christian world and indeed the whole world, and the Zionist element, which grows out of ultimately of an Old Testament or Torah rhetoric of smashing all the other tribes' gods and stealing their stuff for Yahweh, who may actually be in some ways a stand-in for the priesthood, that there's a kind of intolerance and inability to see the other's point of view that seems to be in some ways almost built in to the Old Testament and to the Western version of Christianity that might have something to do with why these two currents could be identified with Gog and Magog, as Imran Hossein says.
Well, there is definitely, first of all, I wouldn't necessarily blame the Old Testament. It's a very specific interpretation, which is, I think, a racist interpretation of the Old Testament, which is behind that. And if you look at the Gospels at the time of Christ, the discussion about whether the interpretation should be spiritual or racist was already there. I mean, one of the reasons why part of the Jews at the time of Christ rejected Christ is because he didn't he condemned the racist political interpretation of the Old Testament. But yes, I think their underlying thought is, what do you call it in English, exclusivism, when you feel that you're superior to everybody else. I think that certainly there is a rabbinical teaching, certainly, that places Jews on a qualitative level different than the rest of mankind. So there is this exceptionalism, Jewish exceptionalism, and there is a Western exceptionalism too, which I think the roots come from the papacy. So that's why there is a similarity in mindset and philosophy underlying it all. And, you know, eventually an alliance was forged. Now, it was very hard to ally basically rabbinical Judaism and the papacy for a long list of reasons, so I don't think we necessarily want to discuss now. But the Protestant world really became sort of the illegitimate child of a fusion of those two. And the Protestant world very nicely combines, rabbinical elements and Western elements of the papacy into a worldview which is supremacist, which is racist, which is imperialist, and which considers that we are basically superior to everybody else. We have a mission in history. We are the bearers of some kind of superiority. We are, you know, what God wants to either fix nature, that would be the Jewish way of putting it, or to, you know, bring the end of civilization would be the Western way of putting it. But they're talking about the same thing.
Well, isn't it interesting that Trump, who criticized American exceptionalism during his campaign, I was ready to stand up and cheer for the guy when he said that. You know, he's I don't believe in American exceptionalism. Whoa, okay, that's the first time I've heard something that direct and sensible from a presidential candidate. But now here he is showing the worst qualities of somebody who won't entertain the point of view of the other, threatening to totally destroy North Korea and murder like 20 million plus people. And of course, the U.S. has already done that. The U.S. murdered many millions of people, totally destroying North Korea once before. He doesn't even seem to entertain the possibility that somebody in that part of the world, or especially in Korea, would how they would react to this. I mean, the U.S. is bristling with these nuclear weapons, and here's this little country that's been destroyed by the U.S. once before that wants to have a couple of nuclear weapons to make sure that it will never be destroyed again. And empathizing at all with that point of view is—it's just not even possible. It's this kind of arrogance, and especially Trump's rabid way of expressing it, is mind-boggling.
He sounded truly like Obama when he made that speech. I think, if I recall correctly, at West Point, when he spoke about the indispensable nation, it's the same rhetoric. It's the same nonsense. It's very unoriginal. You know, if you look at all the other empires in history, they all had more or less variation on the same of the same stuff. It's not very different from what Hitler had during the Third Reich, or for that matter, communism. You know, promised also, you know, an end of history and the end of history and, you know, the paradise on earth in the form of communism. I mean, it's all the same rhetoric. It's just basic, really garden variety imperialism, poorly presented with a lot of, at least Obama had a little bit of, he was a good speaker. Trump yesterday looked ridiculous.
And I don't think it's going to help him or the U.S. strategic interest. I think the world is now scratching their heads over who sounds crazier, you know, Kim or Trump.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think that's a lot of what's happening. I think that the world can, there is a response to what's happening in the United States and the world. It's an interesting one. It's not confront the U.S. directly, but basically start building up an alternative. Less Europe. Europe has had problems since Trump came to power, but under Obama, the Europeans were, you know, a pathetic little colony with the local elites basically brown-nosing Obama as much as they could and had no opinion on anything. Now they're sort of becoming more aware and more vocal about that there's a problem with the United States. But the rest of the world, if you look what's taking place in Asia, for instance, it's amazing how basically they're just moving on. They don't want to confront the United States because the U.S. is still very powerful. I don't think anybody wants a collapse of the empire because a collapse would have a lot of very dangerous side effects. But they're building up, while Trump is threatening, you know, brimstone and fire from the UN, the rest of the world is busy building up a multipolar society. And I think that's where we're headed.
Well, I hope I can have you back and chart the course toward that multipolar society before too long. It's been a great conversation. I appreciate your excellent work. It's online at thesaker.is. What's IS?
Iceland, not Israel. A lot of people ask me if it's Israel. No, it's Iceland.
Okay, well, coming to you live from an undisclosed location in Iceland. Well, not live and not really from Iceland. Anyway, this has been Kevin Barrett talking with The Saker, one of our most interesting and important alternative voices. Thank you so much. Keep up the great work. God bless.
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's been a pleasure. Same to you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.